As I indicated, this is A24-1235 in re the guardianship, and I would ask the opponent or to correct me, Ahmad Al-Faith, Ahmad Tawil. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, and then the appellant will finally have 5 minutes. Do we have two respondents?
We just have two counts. I'm giving your representations as my co-counsel.
Okay, so fine. All right.
There are two parts to this case. We have the guardianship case.
Yes.
There's a dissolution going on.
Okay.
I'm involved in that as well.
So all right. But you won't be arguing. Thank you very much. Then whenever appellant is ready, just approach the microphone. It goes up and down. And just please tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm sorry. I was setting up when you first started speaking. I have 15 minutes, correct?
Yes, sir. And then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Turn up and down.
Yes, it does. There is a button
in front of you.
In front of me.
Maybe the marshal could
show. I see it. Thank you.
There you go. Yes. Take your time.
Thank you.
The button costs $200,000, so I'm glad it works.
I'm sorry, what was that?
The button costs $200,000, so I'm glad it works.
I'm ready, Your Honors. Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Jason Chalik. I'm an attorney with the Autism Advocacy and Law Center, appearing this morning on behalf of the appellant. Your Honors, this is an appeal from a guardianship case in district court, Scott County District Court. I think it's important for the court to understand from the outset, we are here with an order that neither party wanted. My client, the appellant, petitioned the district court for a sole guardianship for the party's now adult son, Ahmed. In response, the respondent, Mr. Tawil, petitioned the district court for a co-guardianship, withdrew that petition, and then asked the court to appoint himself as Ahmed's sole guardian. We proceeded to evidentiary hearing. After a two-day trial, the district court issued an order appointing both appellant and respondent as co-guardians. Again, a outcome that neither of them asked for, and it is our position that it is an erroneous outcome.
But what case law do you rely on that says that a district court can't do exactly what it did?
So, Your Honor, I practice in this area quite extensively, and in re the guardianship of Schmidt, the court can do that. The court can certainly, after hearing and hearing from the parties, the court has the authority to appoint folks as co-guardians, even though they don't want to.
All right, so it's not an error of the court. What you're really arguing is that it was an abuse of the court's discretion to put the two parents together.
That, Your Honor, that's correct. So there are three points that we made in our brief. One is whether there was an abuse of discretion in appointing respondent without having complied with statutory requirements. And the second is whether the court committed clear error when it found that it was in Ahmed's best interest to have both parents serve, even though one was more qualified. And then third, Your Honor, getting to your point, really the strongest point in the argument that should most concern this court is whether it was an abuse of discretion to appoint my client, the appellant, who is the victim of domestic violence, to serve with the respondent who perpetrated the domestic violence against her to serve as co-guardians for Ahmed. And the case
and
law...
And on that third point, what did the court say?
The court made very little findings regarding what kind of behavior occurred between the two parents. We were not allowed to sort of relitigate what happened with domestic violence.
It did note that the Danko expired, or was going to expire on November 29th, 2024. It seems to me that went a long way to explaining why the court was doing what it did, even though there was a Danko. Now, why is that wrong? I mean, if the Danko was expiring, then that would suggest some of the issues that I'm sure you're going to advise us would not be present, i.e., you know, visitation, you know, dealing with handoffs, dealing with the children, excuse me, the child, all of those things. So go ahead.
You know, two responses. So just because the DANCO expires doesn't mean the underlying criminal conduct, the domestic violence between the two of them, didn't occur. And by issuing the order that we have, the district court is compelling my client to serve as co-guardian in an ongoing, indefinite legal relationship with the person who abused her. The court has to make decisions.
But, I mean, that goes to your client. That doesn't go to the child's best interest.
So well, sure it does, Your Honor. The court has to make a decision regarding what is in Ahmed's best interest. Is it in the best interest?
And wouldn't that, and normally speaking, wouldn't it be in the best interest to have both parents as guardians, considering that he does have relationship with both mother and father?
Co-guardians have to work together to be effective and functional. My client continues to be afraid of the respondent. He committed acts of domestic violence against her. There was a criminal case. He pled guilty to disorderly conduct. And another point that I need to make is, although the DANCO did expire in November or December of last year, I checked MCR yesterday, and it looked like it actually expired in December. Regardless, there's also an order for protection in place between the two of them. And throughout respondent's brief,
resulting order of the court, wasn't it without findings?
The stipulated order for protection, Your Honor, was without findings. However, that began July 25th, 2023, has not expired, and that continues through July of this year, so July of 2025. The district court didn't make any findings regarding the order for protection.
So kind of in the broader sense, what I'm hearing you arguing is that, look, there was this domestic violence between the couple, and much like in family court, you do not have to mediate, you do not have to participate in things when you have an order for protection or a violence. Are you saying to extend that to a legal matter that affects a guardianship, that the same issues would predominate, that one person has a higher bargaining power or fear, as you said your client has? I mean, is that what you're attempting us to subscribe to, that notion that we should expand that protection?
It's not using the guardianship proceeding to extend protections to my client. The guardianship is to protect Ahmed, the person subject to guardianship.
Right. Well, I'm not being clear. I'm just saying that in the world of domestic violence, there's a lot of things that a couple does not have to participate in because there's been a determination of violence, such as court of appeals mediation, such as trial court mediation, and things like that. So I'm wondering if you're suggesting that should be broadened to any legal proceeding that binds two people that have had a history of violence, if that is in fact what they have.
There's no case law on that, Your Honor. I think, you know, the facts here do strongly suggest that forcing my client's the appellant, to be in this ongoing legal relationship where she has to, as co-guardian, she now has to work with the person who abused her indefinitely, making medical decisions, making decisions regarding government benefits, taking him to medical appointments, educational decisions, special educational decisions. So the person who abused her caused her to go to the hospital. She still has rotator cuff injuries that have not fully healed.
I don't know that. It's not in our record.
It is in the record.
Is it in the record?
It is in the record.
But how would that be different if, you know, unfortunately in many you know, family divorce cases, separation cases, there have been instances of domestic abuse, and there are still children, mm-hmm. and, you know, sometimes the court grants sole custody, sometimes it grants joint custody, and, you know, there are ways to get around the parents', the mother's fear, justifiably so, in order to deal with both parents having access to the children and both parents participating in the children's, you know, life-changing decisions. So, I mean, we do that all the time. Why is this so different?
It's different because we're not in family court anymore, Your Honor. So there is a pending dissolution proceeding. But once Ahmed turned 18, all of the family court statutes on the best interest of the child, the 12 or 14 best interest factors the court has to look at, that doesn't apply here.
No, I mean, I understand that guardianship is different from custody, but all the time we sort of have to make do with these situations, and both parents have to deal with the child, in this case, because of the particular child's situation, he needs a guardianship. We're making both parents deal with that. How is that different? I mean, are you saying there are no parameters that could be, I mean, presumably, if we affirm this decision and there was another incident or there was some other breakdown in how the guardianship was being managed by both adults, you could go back to court and move for a modification or a termination, right?
Sure. So the guardian and guardians are always subject to the jurisdiction and direction and control of the probate court. I don't want to have to wait until she's abused again. It happened once. And the evidence in the record indicates that the dispute that happened between the two, now co-guardians, was a dispute regarding what kind of medications to give to Ahmed. My client wanted to administer some medications to Ahmed. Father didn't. There was a physical altercation, and he ended up not getting his medications that day. Making medical decisions is the fourth power of guardianship under the probate statute, and that the fact that they had to make, as parents, a medical decision together led to my client being injured, and the injuries, the results of which continue to last today. I don't know what other evidence I could have presented to the district court to show that these two individuals should not be compelled to work together. I don't want to wait until there's another incident.
The Danko had carve-outs for communication to allow parenting exchanges. Is that correct?
That is correct. So the Danko was Exhibit 7, Your Honor. That allowed text contact regarding the child and visitation, in-person mediation with a third party present, and then in-person parenting time exchanges.
Okay. So you disagree then with the position that I think opposing counsel takes, which is that the issue about the Danko is moot because it expired in November or December of last year.
So 2 points on that, Your Honor. The Danko did expire. I agree with that. It doesn't mean the underlying conduct, criminal conduct, that led to a charging decision by prosecutors, that hasn't gone away.
And that was considered by the district court in making its decision to appoint both parents as co-guardians, correct?
That was, and the district court did in its order make findings about that. Mm-hmm. The district court failed to make any findings regarding the order for protection, which is Exhibit 32 in the record. That was the stipulated order, and I think the respondent mixes the two of them up in respondent's brief. And when respondent talks about the stipulated Danko, there's no stipulated Danko. The Danko comes from the criminal court. Regardless, Your Honor, the language in the Danko prohibits in-person communication between the two of them, and that will expire in July.
It limits communication. The relationship is difficult. I think the district court understood that the communication between the two parents would be difficult. But the way I understand this is that the district court also decided that based on the best interests of the individual who would be subject to the guardianship, that is the overarching question that it answered here, which is that it's still in Ahmed's best interests for both parents to work towards cooperation to make decisions together. And so I guess I want to hear from you why that decision was an abuse of the district court's discretion.
Because, Your Honor, co-guardians have a duty, they're court-ordered to cooperate and to act together in Ahmed's best interests and jointly make decisions that affect his welfare, jointly make decisions that protect his interests, and make decisions for him on issues that he can't decide for himself. The two, and the district, the record is has much evidence about the breakdown of the marital relationship and how these two individuals simply cannot work together anymore. They don't agree about his diet. They don't agree about where he should be going to school. They disagree about what medications that he should be taking. And again, that disagreement about what kind of medications Ahmed should be taking led to a physical altercation that led to my client needing emergency medical attention. So to answer your point directly, the district court simply got it wrong. Forcing these two individuals to work together, one the victim of domestic violence, one the person who committed domestic violence against her, into this ongoing legal relationship where they cannot cooperate. Legally, they're not even allowed to communicate voice to voice until July of 2025. How can that be the arrangement that best serves Ahmed's interests when his co-guardians can't get along and are not able to make joint decisions about him? That's my
response. Well, the findings in the record were that both parents were capable of providing for Ahmed. Both of the findings in the record show that there was testimony about the quality of the relationship that he had with both parents, and maintaining that seems like that was what the district court was pointing to.
And there's certainly, Ahmed can, if my client were appointed the sole guardian for Ahmed, which is what we're seeking, he can still maintain a relationship with his father. Under Minnesota's Guardianship Bill of Rights, my client, if she were sole guardian, is prohibited from interfering with communication between Ahmed and persons of his choice, including his father. So even if they were not co-guardians, Mr. Tawil still enjoys as much time and visitation with Ahmed as Ahmed wants. Judge, I see I have 19 seconds left. I'll leave it at that. I will probably have a couple of comments in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning again to the court. Gregory Seaman appearing to make oral argument on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Tawil. And I wanted to first address the brief of the appellant in this matter as far as the overall view of the appellant's argument. First of all, I understand from oral argument today there was no resuscitation of the procedural arguments leading up to the evidentiary hearing. In other words, there was extensive argument about notices given while Mr. Tawil was pro se.
No, that doesn't, speaking for myself only, not my treasured colleagues, that doesn't concern me. I mean, I think I didn't see the actual harm or prejudice here, but could you go to his main point, which is how on earth is this going to work?
And having practiced in the family courts of the Twin Cities for the last 40 years now, I can tell you, I agree that it's going to be a very difficult road for these two to work together. However, I do think...
how do you propose? I mean, I did not see, you know, are you suggesting then that there's going to be another hearing where if this decision is affirmed, they're going to have to come up with some procedure to deal with these joint decisions that you know, they both have a right to sort of, you know, veto the other? I mean, how is this going to work? I mean, it's not sort of much supervised visitation. I'm concerned about is, you know, what are they going to do when, you know, one of them wants to give him, you know, Chipotle and the other one says no? How is that going to work?
And again, I think all co-guardians face that same kind of decision-making. This may be a bit more extreme due to the divorce proceedings that are ongoing at this time, and it's making
it more apparent.
I think
counsel for the appellant is not so much focused on divorce proceedings. There are lots of divorce proceedings.
True.
He's focusing on the domestic violence issue, which, you know, adds another dimension to this, not to mention, you know, the dealing with an autistic child is difficult enough. So how explain to me how this is going to work.
Well, we certainly cannot prevent the appellant from bringing motions after the co-guardianship were to be approved by the court, if in fact that's the case. We just can't predict that. That's total speculation on our part as to whether or not that would occur. What we do know is that they've been texting.
Well, did the district court set up parameters as to, you know, how this co-guardianship is going to work? And given the facts of this case, was that an abuse of discretion to not explain, okay, you know, best of luck, you know, make it work? I mean, I'm well aware that your strongest argument is our standard of review, but what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, even an abuse of discretion can be abused, and how is this going to work?
I don't have an answer for how this will work because
Do we have to reverse and remand to have the district court come up with an explanation as to how this is going to work? Or, if it can't, you know, terminate the co-guardianship and you know, go with one or the other?
Up until this point, since the party started renewing their communications on the point of visitation with the child, they have had success in that realm.
And is that in the record?
That is not in the record of what the district court ruled.
I can't, you know, we got to go with what's in the record. And,
correct.
And you know, that's just the way it works here. So explain to me, is there anything in the record that would support the idea that this co-guardianship would work?
There is nothing in the record, given the history of the parties in this case, that would suggest it would work.
What I understand is, from your briefing, that one of your concerns is that mom would somehow restrict dad's ability to have a relationship with the son. Appellant counsel has just indicated that is a power that is not permitted. So does... How are your fears not taken care of because of the restrictions on that?
Well, as far as if she were to be awarded sole guardianship, yes, there are provisions to protect my client's interest in terms of communication. There's no protections for her to say no, consistently no. I don't wish him to go to this place for that reason, no. I don't agree with you that even though you have access to medical records regarding her son, we disagree.
So his fear is that she's going to dominate and rule with an iron fist, prohibiting him from having meaningful input?
I believe that will be the case. That's the greatest fear on our side. Their greatest fear is they won't work together. Our greatest fear is, just like the judge indicated, or I should say, as our primary witness, Ms. Ferris, the expert witness called by our client during the evidentiary hearing, suggested, the danger here is that if you take away the co-guardianship status, that she would abuse that privilege to the detriment of the best interest of the ward. And what you'll notice in the testimony as it breaks down for appellant in this case, the word no, it seems to be her favorite word. It's basically, do you believe he should be co-guardian? No. Do you believe he should have input on medical records? No. Do you believe he should? And the list goes on and on, that she basically believes she's one and done. She makes the decision, he abides by it, and whether or not impacts negatively the best interest of the child, or not child in this case, now the adult, is not her concern. Her concern is control. And I'm afraid it goes right back to what the initial questions were from the panel, which is, how does this work? Realistically, it's going to be hard. It's going to be very hard. Now, as far as what the district court could have done in terms of the findings in the order, to speculate as to whether or not these parties would cooperate under their statutory requirements as co-guardians to protect the best interest of their son, you know, that's something that I don't think the court could predict. I can't believe it's an abuse of discretion if the court refuses to speculate on how these parties will behave after an order issues. If I may return to a couple of other points from my argument as prepared this morning. Basically, in regard to the testimony of the parties, in terms of credibility, I believe the court properly weighed out the testimony of the parties. As we indicated in our brief, the testimony of the appellant, and her two witnesses, one a sister who doesn't even live in the state of Minnesota and very seldom sees the child interact with either mother or father, the other being a teacher who taught the child over 6 years ago, as being her best witnesses to support her position that she be sole guardian. We believe those are basically defeated by our client, who brought forward the court-appointed supervisor of parenting time with our client, who indicated her concerns that mom continues.
Did the court-appointed supervisor testify that, therefore, in her, I believe it was a woman, in her opinion, am I right?
Yes.
Okay. That a co-guardianship would be best?
Yes. Okay. That basically her concern.
So she said, she said a co-guardianship would be in the best interest of the child. That's in the record?
My recollection specifically is she said it would not be in the best interest of the child to be solely in mom's guardianship because she would act to preclude or interfere with dad's relationship. So by inference, I'm not sure if I'm using that word correctly, I believe that is supportive of the co-guardianship because she says we have to have them both in with equal footing in order to protect the relationship.
Well, I can assure you we'll be checking that.
Sure.
Because, I mean, it's one thing for the co-guardianship for the expert to say, you know, he lights up when dad's around, he was happy to see dad, that was great, which I'm sure is true, but it's a leap to go from there to say, oh, and therefore, it shouldn't be a sole guardianship. So you're saying there was actual testimony by the expert on the exact issue, which is the subject of this appeal, whether there should be a sole guardianship or a co-guardianship.
I believe in the documents I have to my left here, I do have the quotations from her indicated, but I can recite
Fair
that
enough.
On rebuttal. In regard to the Danko and the order
What's her name, by the way? The
Ferris.
Ferris, that's right.
Ms. Ferris,
I apologize.
Yes.
Thank you.
And in regard to the argument raised as to why co-guardianship cannot work, the Danko and the order for protection that remains in place, my client did not make admissions of abuse. Nowhere in these orders is it going to say my client made admissions.
Does the record indicate he pled guilty?
He pled guilty in regard to the Danko. And the order for protection was issued with no findings.
But correct me if I'm wrong, he did plead guilty to disorderly conduct. Is that a correct
statement? I believe, yes.
Okay, fair enough. Which I get is not an OFP and not domestic assault, I get it.
And our research indicated, coming up to this case, indicates that there is no case law that I'm aware of that says if you have a Danko or if you've had an order for protection, you're automatically precluded or excluded from serving as a guardian.
I think that is a correct statement of the law.
I believe that the court is correct that we have basically three options here. We have our option is preferred is the affirmation of the lower court's order. We do believe that the memorandum attached to the district court's order does recite enough information for the court to determine that he considered the best interest of the child in weighing out the rights of both parents to serve as co-guardians. We believe that is in the record. We believe that's what should be done. However, fully understanding, and I will not dispute with Your Honor, that is this going to work? It's going to depend on the courage of the two parents to do what's best for their child and to work together, even after the issues that have arisen before. We have no way to guarantee that outcome. The district court has no way to guarantee that outcome in advance. It simply has to be the party's willingness and desire to follow the court order and the intentions of the court. So that option of reversal then remand for additional findings, that would make some sense. One of the things that was concerning about appellant's brief was this presumption that the court couldn't make a co-guardianship in this type of setting. And again, I found no case law that prevents the district court from awarding co-guardianship in this type of case. The court can express a preference. The court can weigh out the preferences based on the qualifications of each of the applicants. And that's what we believe the court did in this case. But we do believe the court was totally within its right to award a co-guardianship based on the statements of the court and the findings of the court, which support the conclusion that the best interest of this ward will be met by both parents retaining guardianship status in this case. Unless there's another question, I'll release the rest of my time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Seaman.
Thank you.
Counsel for the appellant, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to briefly touch on a couple of the points that counsel brought up during
it. What did Ferris say in the record about co-guardianship or sole guardianship? What did she say?
I believe my recollection of Ms. Ferris's testimony is that she had concerns that if my client's mother were appointed sole guardian, that would interfere with father being able to see Ahmed. I don't believe she rendered an expert opinion on who should, on whether or not the two should or should not be co-guardians. It's a little bit muddy because I understand counsel's point about perhaps trying to make an inference from that. I don't believe she directly said the two of them should be appointed co-guardians. Furthermore, I think a more important point is that Ms. Ferris is not a guardianship expert. She's not an expert at all. She is the parenting time supervisor who is in charge.
No, but I mean, it seemed to me the district court put a lot of weight on her testimony.
I believe.
And not on the sister or the teacher.
I think you're probably right, Your Honor.
And so if I mean, I think if that seems to be the case, then, what Ferris's concerns were, even if she did not say co-guardianship, you know, or not, that her concerns relating to dad being frozen out did play into the mix of the court's decision on co-guardianship.
So, Your Honor, guardianship is about substitute decision-making.
Yep.
It's about making decisions for somebody who's vulnerable and is incapacitated and is unable to make their own decisions. Guardianship is not parenting time and supervised visitation. So to the extent that Ms. Terrace testified, she testified regarding her observations of family law issues. So she did not testify that she observed either of them making any medical, legal, government benefits decisions. All of those are solid guardianship powers. She was solely there to observe the parenting time in a supervised manner.
What did she say about the dieting issue, the diet issue in terms of, because it seemed to me that also played into, you know, it seemed like the court was sort of, you know, suggesting that the diet decisions made by mother were questionable, and then when the dieting decisions came, or when dad came into some of the food intake issues, things got a lot better. So how does that play in, counsel?
So I think that, you know, the second power of guardianship is to take care of the care, comfort, and maintenance needs of the person subject to guardianship. So I'd concede that deciding and making decisions about a diet would be a guardianship-related decision. My recollection is that when some of the supervised parenting time sessions first started, Ahmed didn't want to eat some of the things that my client had chosen for him at either Chipotle or Chick-fil-A. Father selected some things, and Ahmed seemed to like those better. My recollection also is that the decisions that my client made about diet were not necessarily medically prescribed, but based on her observations of Ahmed and how he did better behaviorally with a gluten-free diet. I don't recollect a whole lot more about Ms. Fair's testimony.
Counsel, I am very familiar with guardianships. Usually, I think it's better to have co-guardians because you have someone to share the burden with, you have someone to help get someone to their appointments. Typically, that's the preferred, that's a preferred situation. And so I'm just trying to understand here why, I mean, you want us to find that there was an abuse of discretion. But it seems like it was well within the court's discretion to decide that two co-guardians were going to serve the best interests of this individual better.
And I think the court got it wrong. So what I heard from opposing counsel is it's going to be difficult, it's going to be hard, but we hope it works out. That is not the legal standard. The legal standard is what is in Ahmed's best interest. Mm-hmm. The court, I think, improperly considered what is in Ahmed's best interest and appointed two people to serve as his co-guardians, one of whom committed a crime against the other, and two of whom do not get along and cannot make decisions jointly for Ahmed. This isn't family court. These two do no longer have fundamental parental rights. Ahmed's an adult. The rights the court should be concerned about are Ahmed's rights, and it's our position that the court's order appointing these two as co-guardians is not in Ahmed's best interest, and we ask the court to reverse.
Would you agree that in guardianships there are individuals who are subject to them that have greater needs, and it exists along a spectrum? And given this individual's their diagnoses and their cognitive levels, that they need more help than perhaps others, more than most, to make those decisions. I mean, you're talking about the powers that are given to the guardians in terms of making daily decisions, whether that be diet, residence, medication, et cetera. I mean, essentially, the co-guardians are going to have to work together to make all of those decisions for him based on his ability levels, my understanding. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. I think in an ideal world, in my firm, we do co-guardianships with up to three or four people, mm-hmm. because they get along. We've worked with divorced parents before who are able to get along for the sake of protecting their adult child's interests. This case is not that.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, counsel. The matter was well argued, well briefed. We are aware of the importance of the underlying issues. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome, sir.